Jotcast, December 2025 edition, with Sohini Datta, Emily Walls, Josh Bishop, Louisa Mason, Jesse Marin, Barbara Cabrales, and Jordan Norris.
Hello, and welcome to the Jotcast. I'm Emily, and joining me in the studio are Josh and Sohini. In this month's episode, Jesse and Barbara had the opportunity to speak to Dr. Kai Schmitz of the University of Munster about the first results from the pulsar timing array and how this could affect our understanding of early universe cosmology. Then we have Louisa and Sohini providing an end-of-year roundup for the Jotcast, talking about the highlights of 2025 and where we are going in 2026. Then, in our Jod Bite with Catherine Edmondson, Louisa speaks to her about her work detecting and characterising exoplanets. But first, the news.
What a missing signal tells us about alien worlds. When the James Webb Space Telescope detected potential biosignatures in the atmosphere of K2-18b last year, the discovery sparked intense debate. It was an exoplanet possibly harbouring methane, carbon dioxide, which are gases produced by plankton on Earth. A team of researchers turned to the Carl G. Jansky Very Large Array to find out, searching for radio emissions from K2-18's host star. Over 12 weeks, they listened at multiple frequencies between 2 and 10 gigahertz, hoping to detect the telltale radio signatures of stellar magnetic activity. What they found was remarkable. In the fact, they found nothing. That silence matters more than you might think. Radio emissions reveal the magnetic environment surrounding a star and its planets. Active stars produce stellar winds that can strip away atmospheres over millions of years. The fact that K2-18 produces no detectable radio emission suggests it's unusually quiet, which is great if you're a nearby planet. The observations support earlier X-ray data showing K2-18 is a remarkably faint emitter. Previous calculations suggested that the planet would lose only about 3% of its mass over its entire lifetime, far less than the catastrophic stripping that planets around more active stars suffer. The researchers search for both steady radio emission from the star's corona and brief bursts that may indicate stellar flares or even auroral activity from the planet's magnetosphere. They found neither, placing strict upper limits on the system's radio output. If K2-18 does produce flares, they must be rare and weak compared to the typical M-dwarf stars.
Japanese spacecraft faces a massive challenge from a house-sized asteroid. Hayabusa 2 is an asteroid sample return mission operated by the Japanese State Space Agency. Launched in December 2014, it has already visited near-Earth asteroid 162173 Ryugu for a year and a half to collect samples and return them to Earth in December 2020. Now its mission has been extended through to at least 2031, where it will rendezvous with the small, rapidly rotating asteroid 1998 KY26. New observations using observatories across several continents, including the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope, show that the asteroid is a mere 11 metres across, and spinning twice as fast as previously thought. This discovery adds complexity to Hayabusa's 2031 mission, but also heightens scientific interest. 1998 KY26 was discovered on the 1st of June 1998 by the Spacewatch Telescope at the Stewart Observatory. Despite its small size, the asteroid reached magnitude 16 thanks to its close approach to Earth, just two lunar distances away. 1998 KY26 holds significant relevance for planetary defence, as its size is comparable to the Tunguska and Chelyabinsk impactors. Studying 1998 KY26 also contributes to establishing links between meteors and their parent bodies, and it provides a valuable opportunity to bridge the understanding of size extremes within the near-Earth object population, offering insights into physical characteristics and behaviours of small asteroids. Additionally, its rapid rotation could complicate operations for instruments, requiring longer integration times. On the positive side, though, the absence of detectable dust around the object could facilitate close proximity operations. Importantly, these factors have been identified 6 years ahead of the rendezvous. If successful, Hayabusa 2 will provide invaluable in-situ data on a rare, bright, decameter object, offering unique insights into this class of asteroids.
James Webb Space Telescope spots a gassy baby galaxy throwing a tantrum in the early universe. Using JWST, astronomers recently observed a young galaxy which existed when the universe was less than 500 million years old, making it part of the first generation of large galaxies that formed after the Big Bang. What makes it remarkable is its frantic pace, forming stars at about 165 times the mass of our Sun every year. That's over 16 times the star formation rate of our own Milky Way. When galaxies undergo rounds of intense star formation like this, they produce a lot of large, bright stars. These stars produce tremendous outflows of particles and radiation, like solar wind on steroids. They also die. A lot. They explode as tremendous supernovae almost as soon as they are born. This creates outflows that eject gas at speeds of more than 500 km per second, three times the galaxy's escape velocity. Once that gas is gone, it's gone for good. The team estimates that this galaxy will exhaust its gas supply in only a few hundred million years, transforming into a more quiescent galaxy thereafter. And another twist. Despite its young age, the galaxy already shows rich heavy element abundances, which suggests an even earlier generation of stars must have existed. Altogether, the finding challenges some of our simpler models of early galaxy growth. It seems these early systems matured and possibly burnt out much faster than expected.
And that was the news. Now we hand over to Josh, who's going to introduce our first interview.
Our first interview is with Dr. Kai Schmitz from the University of Munster. He talks to us about the initial results from the pulsar timing array. The PTA uses changes in the length of pulses emanating from local pulsars to probe the cosmic gravitational wave background, a still theoretical equivalent to the cosmic microwave background you might have heard of before, but now with gravitational waves. He highlights his team's initial results, hinting that there is strong evidence suggesting it exists, and tells us how this could lead to further insights into lingering questions in early universe cosmology.
Hi everyone, I'm Jesse.
And I'm Barbara.
And joining us in the studio today is Kai Schmitz. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Kai, so you previously worked at CERN and are now a junior professor on a tenure track and also the lead of the particle cosmology group at the University of Munster. And you gave us a fantastic talk yesterday highlighting the first results of the pulsar timing array. Could you give us a brief outline of what the pulsar timing array is?
Yes, I'd love to, of course, yes. Yeah. So pulsar timing arrays, or PTAs for short, are a method, a way to search for gravitational waves in our Milky Way. And they basically represent sort of virtual gravitational wave detectors of galactic dimensions. So we don't use any devices, detectors here on Earth to search for gravitational waves. But in a PTA measurement, we actually observe pulsars in the Milky Way. Pulsars are dead stars, neutron stars, that emit electromagnetic radiation from their magnetic north and south poles. And you can think about them basically as cosmic lighthouses in the sky. They give us this flashing light signal with a very high periodicity, a very stable signal. They go blink, 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 blink in the sky. And we can use them basically as perfect clocks, almost perfect clocks in the sky. And then if we monitor those pulsars over long periods of time, years or even up to decades, we can try to search for tiny distortions in this sequence of pulses reaching us from the pulsars. And those tiny distortions could be induced by gravitational waves. So you can think about gravitational waves, maybe an entire background of gravitational waves washing through our galaxy, the Milky Way, and then stretching and squeezing distances in the Milky Way, including the distances between those pulsars and our radio telescopes here on Earth that we use to observe pulsars. And if this happens, if a gravitational wave stretches and squeezes those spatial distances, then this will induce tiny distortions in the light travel times of those pulses, and thus also tiny distortions in the arrival times of the pulses. And that's what PTAs are trying to detect, those tiny distortions in the pulse sequence from individual pulsars in the sky. And to be sure to really dig out the gravitational wave signal, it's not enough to just look at one individual pulsar in the sky, because in that case, you can never be sure whether it's really a gravitational wave signal that you're seeing, but you want to look at a whole array, a network of pulses in the sky, and then see whether you find the right type of correlation or pattern emerging in the comparison of the data for the individual pulsars. And that's why we observe the entire array, the PTA, to search for gravitational waves. And as you were just saying, this entire field is now at a very exciting stage because now there is, we say, compelling evidence for a signal. So it looks like that a signal for a gravitational wave background really is now in our latest data sets.
So you mentioned that it's important that we have more than one pulsar so that we have this array. Is there a specific number of pulsars that is good to have to detect gravitational waves? Do we want as many as possible?
Yeah, I think in general, the more the better, the more the merrier. But number of pulsars is basically one of the parameters that affect or that determine the sensitivity of a PTA, of a pulsar timing array measurement. If you have very good observations of pulsars and it's only just a small number, but your timing precision is very good and you've been observing them for a long time, even in this case, you can learn much about the gravitational wave signal that's potentially in the data. For instance, the European Pulsar Timing Array, EPTA, and I think there are also members of the EPTA collaboration here at the University of Manchester, they have excellent data for many pulsars, but then if they take the data they have for maybe the best six pulsars in their data set, because they've been observed for such a long time and the timing precision is so high, even with this small number of pulsars, they can get to a significant measurement and evidence for a gravitational wave background. But having said that, yes, it's true, more pulsars help a lot. And I think this is also one of the directions into which the field is moving. So now we get the different regional PTAs around the world, different PTA teams. And in one of the next steps, those PTA collaborations want to combine the data set. And in the context of what's called the IPTA, the International Pulsar Timing Array, and then create PTA data sets as large as never seen before, and also including a number of pulsars as large as never seen before. So in that case, then containing more than 100 pulsars. And I think that's going to be sort of what we aim for now, and hopefully also the standard in the future, to really have PTA data sets with 100 or maybe hundreds of pulsars at some point in the future.
Awesome. And so once we measure the changes in the timings of all those pulsars, how do we process the data and what kind of results can we hope to get?
Well, I mean, this is work that's done by different working groups inside the collaborations. I can speak for NanoGraph because I'm a member of the NanoGraph collaboration from North America. In NanoGraph, we have certain collaboration members, experts, who are responsible for the pulsar observations. They basically do the observations, obtain the data, make sure that we curate them in the right way, make them accessible, store them, make them permanently available. And then we've got a timing working group that's responsible for what you just said, right? The analysis of the data set and then digging out the observables that we're interested in, those timing residuals. That's the name of those most crucial observables in the measurements. And I think here the hard part of the work really is to develop dedicated what's called timing models for the individual pulsars. So you basically have to tend to each pulsar individually and then try to get to know it, learn more about it, yeah, and then see what this one particular pulsar is up to. So then you've got a toolbox, including a couple of tools that you can use to construct your timing model. But again, every pulsar is different, and then it's really, some people say it's a dark art to work out these timing models. But of course, I mean, there are some certain principles behind that that guide you in constructing such a timing model. But in any case, yeah, so then you have to understand, okay, what determines the timing signals from each individual pulsar. You would like to subtract as many or basically all deterministic contributions, as many as possible. Anything that's related to the motion of the pulsar itself, its dynamics in a binary system, if it's got a companion, and all of this. So you do the best you can to construct this timing model. You subtract all these deterministic contributions, and then what you're left with, timing residuals, which then is fed into the next steps of the data analysis, where we want to see if there is an additional signal in the data, such as a gravitational wave background. And then this is a point in the analysis pipeline where the working groups take over. So again, in NanoGraph, we've got what's called a detection working group. They're mainly concerned with the search and then eventually the detection of the gravitational wave background, basically all the Bayesian and also frequentist data analysis that's necessary for this. Got an astrophysics working group. that's interested in the astrophysical interpretation. So they look at the data from the perspective of astrophysics and how it can originate from supermassive black hole binaries. And then, last but not least, there is the new physics working group in which I'm involved. And then we look at the data from the perspective of, let's say, theoretical particle physicists. And then we then take the data prepared by the other working groups and then try to see whether we can find any signals from new physics scenarios in the data.
So let's start, I guess, with the gravitational wave background. What is the gravitational wave background and what would it mean to detect it?
The gravitational wave background would be a signal in gravitational waves that is different from the gravitational wave events that we've seen so far in ground-based experiments. Yeah, so I guess many people have heard about the first direct detection of gravitational waves by experiments here on Earth, LIGO in particular, but since then also Virgo in Italy and then Kagra in Japan. And those gravitational wave detections and events starting in 2015 have been transient events. Yeah, so these are individual gravitational wave signals that have their origin somewhere in the depth of the universe, very far away from us. They travel in all directions. At some point, they reach Earth and our gravitational wave detectors. And then if we're lucky and if the detectors are on, we see a gravitational wave signal, depending on the type of event, just for a fraction of a second or maybe up to a few seconds, up to a minute or two, something like this. But then those transient events, that's already in the name of those events, they're over. They move on. The gravitational waves maybe continue their journey through the solar system and beyond, but they are no longer in the detectors. That's what we've been seeing so far. A gravitational wave background is different. That's a permanent signal. That's something that's around all the time. A background noise in gravitational waves, if you wish, that if we could detect it, and hopefully, I mean, you can say we're not very close to detection with PTAs, a background would be present at all times and reaching us from all directions in the sky.
And so you made a brief allusion to the signal that you've detected. And so could you briefly, and so without getting too much into the weeds, could you explain what we've detected and how confident are we that this is the true gravitational wave background?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, PTA collaborations around the world, including EPTA that I mentioned before, NanoGraph in the US and North America in general, and other PTA collaborations, PPTA in Australia, Indian PTA in India, and the Chinese PTA in China, they have now announced, we say, evidence for a gravitational wave background in summer 2023. And what we see now in this latest generation of data sets is a signal or evidence for what we call a common spectrum process. So this is an additional contribution that you have to add to your models to explain the arrival times of those pulses from the individual pulsars. And it turns out that the characteristics of that new signal, this new process, needs to be the same among all the pulsars in the PTA. So this already tells us that whatever is now in the data, this new signal, is most likely not related to the individual properties of the individual pulsars. Yeah? So the alternative to this would be just individual pulsar noise. Maybe you see some fluctuations in the data from one pulsar, fluctuations in the data from another pulsar. No, this additional signal, this new signal that we now see, is a common spectrum process, something that affects the data from all pulsars in the same way. That's, of course, already something that you would expect from a gravitational wave background. And actually, the evidence for this type of signal now is very strong. So there definitely is something like this in the data. All right. And now the question is it really gravitational waves? Is it a gravitational wave background? And then to reach this, well, next level of confidence in making this a statement, we have to look at, we have to compare the data among pairs of pulsars. So the technical term here is we have to perform a cross-correlation analysis. What this means is that we have to see how the data for different pulsars behaves, depending on whether two pulsars are very close together in the sky, whether they're separated by a certain angle, maybe 90 degrees, or if they are back-to-back in the sky. And then based on our theory, we have some very clear expectation for how this, we say, correlation, this comparison is supposed to look like. So that's the second piece of information we're interested in. And what's now new since summer 2023 is that we have a very clear indication that the data from the individual pulsars follows this predicted pattern. Maybe just to mention the relevant keyword, the buzzword, it's the Hellings and Downs curve. Yeah? So it has been worked out by two theorists. I'm not entirely sure, actually. Theorists are experimentalists, Hellings and Downs, in the 80s. And then they theoretically described how this correlation pattern is supposed to look like. And you can think of this basically as a fingerprint of a gravitational wave background in those timing residuals of the individual pulsars. That is really a certain pattern that we want to observe in the sky. And the level of significance that we have right now at the moment is that what we have in the data is definitely a consistent theoretical expectation in fundamental science, in particle physics, but then also here in the case of radio astronomy. Before we can talk about a detection, we'd like to reach a certain level of significance. That's what's called a 5 sigma level. And we're not quite there yet. Yeah? So we haven't reached this magical threshold, the certain amount of confidence of 5 sigma yet. But depending on the data set that you look at, it's getting very, very close. And we also see how basically everything in the entire field is moving into the right direction. So we are very short of a discovery, I would say here at this point. If you ask me, I will not say that we have already discovered the gravitational wave background. Yeah, so we will say that right now we have evidence, compelling evidence for a gravitational wave background. But I think in the entire community, there's a strong feeling or understanding that with the next generation of data sets, we'll get closer and closer to this magical threshold of 5 sigma and eventually also surpass it. And so then just a matter of time, maybe a matter of a couple of years from now until we can really talk and speak of a discovery of the gravitational wave background.
And so just for the audience at home, 5 sigma, if I remember well, is a 1 in 3 million chance that the...
That sounds about right, yes.
Yeah, and so it's 1 in 3 million chance that our guess is correct. Awesome. And so there is a tangible signal, even though we're not quite at the 5 sigma yet. And so LIGO detects a compact object, black holes, and neutron star mergers. What are the causes for the waves in the background?
Right, yeah. That's the big question. That's the 1 million... pounds question, or maybe I would say 1 million euro question, but anyway, yeah, that's the big question. And of course, everybody's got their ideas about that. And in the entire PTA community, historically, for years and decades, the expectation has been that we'll see a gravitational wave background coming from super massive black holes at those very low frequencies that we're sensitive to. And in particular, supermassive black holes that live in binary systems, so sort of pairs of these gigantic black holes at the centers of galaxies. They perform this dance at the center of a galaxy. They orbit each other, and as these two supermassive black holes orbit each other in one galaxy, that system will emit gravitational waves, but then the same thing will happen in a neighboring galaxy and in many other galaxies across the entire observable universe. And here the expectation is that then the superposition, the combined signal from all of those individual binary systems at the centers of many, many different galaxies will give you in total a gravitational wave background. We say a stochastic superposition, a stochastic gravitational wave background. So that's sort of the primary astrophysical interpretation. And at the moment, everything is consistent with this interpretation. So this interpretation definitely is viable and well-motivated from the perspective of astrophysics. Still, the data itself doesn't carry a label. It doesn't tell us explicitly, hey, I'm a signal coming from supermassive black hole binaries. And so from this perspective, we must say we don't really know yet at this point. And I think the situation is pretty interesting because in principle, there is another option on the table. So in astronomy and cosmology, we know that cosmological backgrounds exist from the early universe. The most famous example is the cosmic microwave background, the CMB, that's sort of a relic background in photons from the early universe. And now the second option on the table for the origin of this gravitational wave background is that it would be another cosmological background. So if you say that the CMB is maybe the afterglow of the Big Bang, you could speculate that now this gravitational wave background signal is not the afterglow, but the echo of the Big Bang. So it might actually have some, we say, primordial origin in the early universe. This interpretation definitely is much more speculative. The other interpretation in terms of supermassive black holes, that's the maybe more realistic interpretation. But only the fact that there's this alternative possibility has stimulated the creativity and the curiosity of many people in the community. And now, since we've got the new data since summer 2023, many people have started thinking about what it could be in the universe that has maybe given rise to such a cosmological gravitational wave background. And that's also very close to the topic that we're working on in my research group at the University of Münster.
Thank you. That's a really cool answer. I just wanted to ask, you said something a while ago. You said that this could help us discover new physics. What are the new things that we could be looking at here?
Right. So first of all, I should say that at the moment, our current understanding of a particle physics is based on what's called the standard model of particle physics. Yeah, that sort of unified framework that allows us to describe all the known subatomic forces and particles. And the standard model of particle physics has been extremely successful for the last decades. I mean, basically since its inception in the 60s of the last century. But still, it's pretty clear, it's obvious that the standard model is not complete. It lacks explanations for a couple of phenomena. So we know that dark matter is out there in the universe, a form of matter that acts gravitationally, that's very important for structure formation in the universe, but which does not interact electromagnetically via light. And so on and so forth. There's evidence for dark matter. Other questions like dark energy. Then in our current understanding of particle physics, we basically describe matter and antimatter on the same footing. Still, we find ourselves in a universe that's basically only consists of matter. If you just look around, don't see any traces of primordial antimatter. And that also requires new physics, a new process beyond the standard model of particle physics to explain this primordial asymmetry between matter and antimatter. So the conclusion here is that there are lots of many lines of evidence for new physics beyond the standard model. And particle physicists have been very creative in the last decades to invent and think about extensions of the standard model. So we talk about BSM scenarios, scenarios of physics beyond the standard model. And many of them address one or several of the problems I just mentioned. But then at the same time, those scenarios can also, basically as a byproduct, predict the generation of gravitational waves in the early universe. And then we can start talking about different possible sources in those BSM scenarios, scenarios of physics beyond the standard model. And in the early universe, this could then be a cosmological phase transition that gives rise to gravitational waves. Other processes, the theory of cosmic inflation, for instance, that's a stage of accelerated expansion in the early universe, which can also basically make space-time vibrate and produce gravitational waves that live on to the present day and then show up as a gravitational wave background in our PTA data. So there's this whole range of ideas and possibilities, inflation, phase transitions, things called cosmic defects, and so on. And most of them, basically all of them, are predicted by those new BSM scenarios that want to go beyond the standard model of particle physics in one way or another to address the problems I just mentioned.
And so lots of possible explanations, still very much an open mystery. And so I guess, how can we get more clarity? What's next for the IPTA?
Right.
And I guess more particularly for your group?
Yes, yeah. So I think the future is very bright for this entire research field. And what's crucial now is to get more data, longer observing baseline. This means we would like to extend our data sets. At the moment in Nanograph, we have a data set that spans 15 years of pulsar observations. In EPTA, it's even longer, 25 years of observations. And the longer you observe those pulsars in the Milky Way, the more sensitive you become to low frequencies. So this will allow us to extend the frequency range that we're sensitive to. We'd like to observe more pulsars. This will help us to increase the significance of our measurements. And we also want to, of course, improve the precision of our measurements by improving the timing precision. This requires new hardware, maybe new observatories even, all of which is basically on the horizon. Yeah. So at the moment, we have the existing PTA collaborations. They use a large number of radio telescopes around the world. But in the future, then there's also going to be the SKA, the Square Kilometer Array in South Africa and Australia, which is going to be the most capable and powerful radio observatory in the world. And with this new hardware, with those new telescopes, we'll be able to continue our pulsar observations, PTA observations. All of this will help to increase the sensitivity and the precision of the measurement. And that's going to be crucial to obtain more information about what's called the spectrum of the gravitational waves, basically its strength as a function of frequency. It's very similar to what happens in the case of electromagnetism, that we also talk about the electromagnetic spectrum. You know that we can talk about ultraviolet, infrared light, and then so on. So light at different frequencies, and here it's the same. We're interested in the gravitational waves across a spectrum, a frequency spectrum of gravitational waves, and we definitely want to improve our precision for this observable. But on top, we're also interested in measuring other properties of the signal, for instance, how it changes across the sky. So the technical term for this is the anisotropies in the gravitational wave background. At the moment, we just basically see the same signal everywhere in the sky. So we say that's sort of the isotropic signal. But then in the future, we hope that we will be able to see small fluctuations across the sky, these anisotropies. And this will also tell us a lot about the source of the signal. So maybe just a very quick comment on this. If it should originate from supermassive black hole binaries, the source is a discrete population of binary systems. Yeah, so it's a certain number of supermassive black hole binaries in different galaxies, and they will not give us the same signal strength everywhere in the sky. So in that case, it's going to be some anisotropic signal, some fluctuating signal in the sky. In the case of a primordial signal, a gravitational wave echo from the early universe, we expect something that's much, much smoother in the sky. The early universe in general has been very smooth, just featuring very small density fluctuations. And in that case, we would also expect that this gravitational wave background is very smooth across the entire sky. So whether or not we're going to find those anisotropies in the next couple of years will provide us with interesting evidence whether the signal comes from astrophysics or from cosmology. So these are two examples, the spectrum and the anisotropies. And of course, we are trying to find what's called continuous wave signals. These are signals, gravitational waves, from an individual binary system. So if we could show that our PTA data contains a gravitational wave just from one pair of supermassive black hole binaries, maybe in a galaxy over here or a galaxy over there, that would also tell us a lot already. This would tell us that those binary systems exist. They can reach a stage in which they emit gravitational waves. This would be sort of a proof of principle that these are active gravitational wave sources in our universe, and would provide very strong, let's say, circumstantial evidence that also the entire background signal must originate from supermassive black hole binaries.
Do you have maybe a preferred explanation?
The explanation that's close to my heart is, of course, something in the early universe. I mean, I can tell you, I'm a theoretical particle physicist by training. I've been thinking about these more exotic scenarios of physics on the standard model for most of my career. And I mean, that would be a real game changer if PTAs should allow us to look back to the early universe. Yeah, so I think if I had to pick a interpretation that's particularly close to my heart, would be cosmic strings. These are defects, cosmic defects that can form in the early universe in certain scenarios of physics beyond the standard model. So you can think of them basically as almost one-dimensional threads running through the universe. They are super thin. They have some subatomic diameter, but they can reach a length of light years and even longer in the present universe. They're very closely related to the physics of what's called grand unification. Yeah, grand unification is the idea that the subatomic forces at very high energies are unified in some kind of super force. Yeah, so people talk about grand unified theories, or GUTs, GUT theories, GUT models, that's the name. And then in those scenarios, the subatomic forces of the standard model, the strong force, the weak force, and electromagnetism are unified in a GUT, grand unified theory, super force. And what happens then in those scenarios in the early universe is that this super force separates into the individual forces step by step. Yeah? So we talk about phase transitions that basically separate out one force after another to basically arrive eventually at the forces that we see in the standard model. In each of those steps where the unified superforce splits into individual forces is a process that can give rise to these defects in the early universe, including cosmic strings. They could still be around to the present day and act as sources of gravitational waves. So I think this is a pretty exciting possibility, because That's a very hypothetical statement, but if the gravitational waves we are seeing should really originate from cosmic strings, this would really open up a window to particle physics at extremely high energies, energies that we will never be able to reach in terrestrial experiments.
Thank you very much for this really, really fascinating explanation. And so I guess to kind of conclude, this is just the beginning of...
It absolutely is, yes, yeah. So, I mean, this has been an important milestone, I would say, in the field. An important milestone that many people have been looking forward to for years and decades. But in a sense, yeah, really, it's just the starting point of a big adventure that will keep us, the entire community, very busy now in the coming years and in decades. One of the most important breakthroughs in 20th century cosmology was the discovery of the cosmic microwave background. And we have to see how things go, but it may very well be that now in the 21st century, the story will somehow repeat now, not with the cosmic microwave background, but with the gravitational wave background. And we know how much information we are able to extract and get out of the CMB, the cosmic microwave background. So now we hope that we'll be able to maybe even get out a similar amount of information from the GWB, the gravitational wave background.
And so you are a particle physicist by training, but now here you are giving talks to hundreds of astronomers. And so how did you go from particle physics to astrophysics?
Right, yeah. So I think this has been a pretty interesting transformation or trajectory that I've been on. It's true, I'm a particle physicist by training, even though the particle physics I was doing, I've always been doing, was sort of located in the early universe. So I'd always been interested in particle physics in the early universe. If people ask me, Kai, what are you doing? I would say, I do the Big Bang Theory. So particle physics in the early universe and using methods of particle physics to learn how the universe obtained its properties that we observe today. And that led me to a couple of postdoc positions at different institutions around the world working on particle physics. And eventually I ended up at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland. And during that time, I became aware of the latest results from PTAs. So this was an earlier data release by NanoGraph in September 2020. And that data set did not yet contain such strong evidence for a gravitational wave background, but still some first hints that were in the data. And I still remember that it was a Friday afternoon. I was on the way to Italy for a family vacation, and I was checking our preprint server, the archive, where authors and in collaborations, in many cases, upload their papers even before it's published in a journal. And then I noticed that paper by the NanoGraph collaboration, and already from the abstract of the paper, I realized that there are apparently some interesting hints in this latest data set. This was only based on 12.5 years of pulse observations, not 15 years of pulse observations yet, as in the latest data set. And then just earlier the same year, in 2020, I had worked on the possibility of gravitational waves from cosmic strings that I just mentioned a couple of minutes ago. And then I was thinking to myself, hey, so this looks like it's going into the right direction. Yeah. So now there's this PTA measurement. They don't have a detection yet. It's only some very faint evidence, but it looks like that there is a first glimpse of a gravitational wave background now in this data. And just a couple of months ago, I had this paper on gravitational waves from cosmic strings. So I called up my collaborators that had been working on this earlier paper. I told them about those latest results from NanoGraph. And then we thought, okay, we should point this out and then just write a quick response paper in which we say that cosmic strings are among the viable options, one possible source to explain the signal. So then we worked very intensively for a couple of days on this possibility, on this paper. And the next week already, we had a paper on the archive. And in the question, we were asking, has NanoGraph seen first evidence of cosmic strings? Question mark. Well, this was then one of the first papers in a very large number of papers that followed as a reaction to this NanoGraph paper proposing different exotic possibilities for the origin of the signal. But members of the NanoGraph collaboration became aware of that paper because it had been one of the first reactions from the community. And they reached out to me on Twitter back in the day, which no longer exists. Now it's X, but they reached out to me on Twitter And we're asking, how is it possible that you had this quick reaction out? And then I said, well, we basically had done a very similar analysis already before in the same year. And then the code, our numerical code, was ready to produce gravitational wave spectra and all of that. So for us, it had been easy to come up with this quick reaction. And the rest is history. So this is what established contact. And then from there, we just starting to interact more. And I invited one of the NanoGraph members to give a talk at CERN in a colloquium, and then the contact grew to become closer. And at some point, some of the NanoGraph members suggested that I should think about becoming a member of the collaboration, which I found a pretty intriguing idea. So I just went for it, became an associate member of the NanoGraph collaboration in 2021. And then since then, I've been extremely happy to be a member of the NanoGraph collaboration. I've been, I think, one of the first theoretical particle physicists that joined the collaboration. And I realized that in this position, I was able to sort of fill in a gap in the collaboration. I think it's not too common that you have theorists being members of experimental collaborations. And I found sort of a place in the collaboration where I could make myself useful, sort of as an in-house a theoretical physicist who's able to comment on these more exotic interpretations of the signal. So this is how I can make myself useful in the collaboration. And at the same time, I also learned so much from the collaboration and in observing radio astronomers and the experimentalists in that sense. So it has been very beneficial in basically a win-win situation for both sides. So from this point on, then I've been a member of the collaboration, and leading up to the analysis of the next data set, 15 years of NanoGraph data, I already became involved in the work of the collaboration, the search for signals from new physics. So in fact, then for the analysis of this data set, I had been in the position of a project co-lead for this paper, together with a good friend and collaborator of mine, Andrea Mitridate from DAISY in Hamburg, and the two of us were then leading the search for signals from new physics in the NanoGraph 15-year data. And now I can't imagine being in a different position anymore. Yeah, so I love being a member of the community, member of a PTA collaboration, and helping to do my part as the field progresses and as we learn more about the gravitational wave background.
A very interesting career path and lots of interesting results. Kai, thank you so much for stopping by. And for the audience at home, we'll make sure to keep you guys updated on the PTA in future episodes.
All right. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks.
And that was our interview with Dr. Kai Schmitz. We'll now pass back to Emily to introduce the end of year roundup.
2025 has been a busy year for the podcast. So Louisa and Sahini sit down to discuss what we've been up to, highlights from this year's episodes, and what we can look forward to in 2026.
What a great year for the Jodcast this year. With the year coming to a close, I think now is a perfect time to talk about what we've done.
Yeah.
And what we're hoping to do next year. And joining me in the studio is Sahini.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, it's been a great year for Jodcast. I've been really enjoying listening to the podcasts on my commute to the uni. So how many episodes did you release this year?
So in the end, we've released 10 episodes. We took summer off for 2 months as the Jodcasters all go to conferences and things like that. And we've talked about everything from cosmology to cancer cells, fast radio bursts, and a whole host of telescopes in between.
That's so cool. It's really been interesting following you on the journey. What is something new that you have done this year for Jodcast? Because it's been running for quite a while.
So I think something that we've tried to do this year is to start showing the faces behind the voices mm-hmm. that you listen to. So things like, the best way to do that is on social media. And a big shout out to Barbara Cabrales, who's been kind of taking over our Instagram and trying to show what it's like in our little Jodcast office and what it's like to put the podcast together.
Yeah, I have been following you on Instagram and I am really enjoying all the little behind the scenes pictures and all the posts. So it's been cool to see that. Speaking of behind the scenes, what technical or creative challenges did you face? Like, I'm sure it's no easy task producing a podcast like this.
Yeah, so the Jodcast, it takes an army of volunteers to put each month episode together. And for that, we've got a great team here at Jodelbank. So some of them you'll already hear on the show and putting together the interviews and presenting. Some of them you will never hear, but they are just as important.
Yeah.
And they're the people wrestling with the RSS feeds, and they're the ones updating the website and even just editing the audio so it sounds hopefully as good as it can be. This September we took on a new, fresh batch of new recruits.
Including me.
Yeah. Which we're really excited for. Fresh ideas to the team. And so we have now 16, whopping 16 volunteers putting the podcast together. So hopefully you're going to hear more from a range of new voices, as well as some old and familiar voices, as well as those that are going to keep this podcast running well into the new year.
Fantastic. Yeah, this is really nice. I am also really happy to join Jotcast because it's so cool to be part of such a diverse set of people who are like so passionate about something that's not academia. So what unexpected moments happened this year? What do you think? Because we have so many people and so many different personalities. So tell us more about behind the scenes of the production and what happened.
Oh, so I think our top behind the scenes moment was probably we ran our first like live event with the Pint of Science Festival. So here in Manchester, as well as in other towns and cities, they take over pubs and they put on science lectures open to the public, and we took over one of their nights here at Manchester and ran like the Jodcast Live. So we brought along a few of our faces, of our voices, and it was a really exciting night because having an audience live in front of us is not something we do, and so that was a really novel and exciting experience, and it was such a great night. A huge thanks to like Phoebe as well as Jesse and Jamie who put the evening together and ran the evening, and we have a good laugh about it now. It was very stressful at the time because we were hoping to record it was going to be the next month's episode, and we couldn't hear a thing.
Oh,
with the audio.
That's a shame.
Yeah. So it was an evening, it was a brilliant evening if you were there.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, unfortunately not so good if you weren't there. So hopefully we sort that out for the next one because we're keen to do another live event.
Yeah, I think it's such a good idea because I saw so many people who were clearly from the general public across all age ranges sort of attend an astronomy talk essentially and like hear about things that are not spoken about in popular science, I think. I specifically think of my supervisors, so like Phil Bull's talk, because we work in something called the Epoch of Reionization and Cosmic Dawn, that's not really discussed in popular science yet because we haven't observed anything yet. And it was really nice to see that Point of Science and Jotcast gives you an opportunity to like take these ideas to the public. So yeah, I really enjoyed attending that. Hopefully everybody gets to hear it next time.
Yeah, next time. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed, yes.
So I suppose thinking more of the science that we've covered this year, I think, and what a lot of science we have talked about.
Yes, there was such diversity in the science that you covered. What's like something that sparked the most curiosity? Like, did you hear back from the listeners and get questions? Like, is there something that stood out to you?
Oh, so I think one of the most surprising and the best response that we've had this year is actually to our May episode. So Infinite Diversity and Infinite Combinations. And that was our interview with Dame Jocelyn Bell-Burnell, who was incredible, as well as CERN Diversity Officer Louise Cavallo. And the whole episode was all about not necessarily the science, but kind of another aspect, which is actually working in academia and working in STEM. And we got the chance to really kind of discuss one of the issues that has faced especially astronomy, which is kind of gender diversity and the barriers that people face. But it's not just gender, it's all sorts of barriers.
Yeah.
And it's something that nowadays within the department we look to address, and we really hope to change that. But it was really interesting listening to Dame Jocelyn Bell-Burnell, who experienced that firsthand.
Yeah, her story is really, I've heard her talk at a few sort of lectures, and her story is really inspiring in the sense that she kept going for the sake of the science, and she was never discouraged by the fact that so many women around her weren't taken seriously. Yeah, I always love listening to her because I find her story to be incredibly inspiring. And these are important conversations to have.
Definitely.
So, thanks to Jotcast for highlighting that.
So if you were to pick out one result from this year that made you say, like, wow, that changes everything, what would it be?
Interesting. So I think 2025 has been like really, I would say, exciting for astronomy because we have seen so many new experiments launch and so many new discoveries happen. But something that I found very fascinating was that there was this giant structure discovered this year, which is called the Keppel's supercluster. And I think it is the biggest structure discovered so far, if I'm not wrong. So it just makes me really wonder what we have not discovered yet, because we've been doing astronomy for forever, and we have been looking up at the sky with like telescopes and like these advanced experiments for decades now, and we keep discovering these giant structures. So it's sort of, I don't know, like if we have missed structures that are this big, what else have you missed? And that makes me really excited to be an astronomer, because it's like, it's a treasure hunt. You never know what you're going to come across.
Yeah, still a lot of mysteries left.
Yes, left the universe keeps giving.
Yeah.
So speaking of the universe, what concept do you think that was covered by Jotcast that has changed how listeners see the universe this year?
Oh, so we have started to put together like themed episodes to try and do a bit more of a deep dive on a particular field in astrophysics, but also a particular telescope or particular collaboration. And so in October's episode, it was our Symes Observatory special. And this coincided with a meeting here at Manchester. And we got the chance to talk to such a huge range of people involved in this telescope. So from everyone that's physically constructing it, the instrumentation that they're experimenting with, the data processing, the actual physical computing that's needed to deal with that data, as well as the scientists that do the astrophysics at the end of the day. So it was a huge range, and again, a diversity of people from all across the country and all across the world, really. It was really interesting and exciting to see that it really does take an army of scientists to put something, even just one telescope, together. And it's such a huge collaboration. And again, huge shout out to Jonathan Wong and Lily Correa Magnus, who put this episode together and organised it. And it was their idea to shine a spotlight on one of these projects. And hopefully we get to do a bit more of that, especially with projects that we're involved in here at JBCA.
Yeah, that was a really interesting episode. This was also part of my listening journey. Speaking of like big missions and big experiments, which mission do you think will have like the biggest impact on public excitement that's from like this year? Or which mission do you think has had the biggest impact on public?
Yeah, so I think for public excitement and my own excitement, the LSST is going to be hugely, it's just so exciting. And so there's excitement for both the scientists as well as the public engagement. And it's this telescope is housing one of the largest cameras in the world. And the Vera Rubin Observatory is planning to observe the sky every few nights. So it's really going to open the door to a part of the universe we kind of still yet to explore a lot of. And that's things that we call transients. So whether that's supernova explosions, or even just the tiny flickers of interstellar objects. And we've seen in the news that interstellar objects are certainly quite exciting, the closer they are to home. So yeah, Vera Rubin is going to be an incredible instrument. And I think the first images were of June this year, many more to come. As the survey rolls out, I'm sure there'll be a lot of surprises waiting around the corner.
Oh, there always is with every new survey. Yeah, I mean, I'm also looking forward to more pretty images associated with astronomy.
We have a few to choose from,
we
don't
have a
we?
Few.
We do.
Indeed.
What about, so this year, what top three moments do you wish everyone had a look at and gone out and explored?
Ooh, so I think, I hope people got to see the auroras that were happening, like I think early this year. There was also the nice blood moon that I hope people saw. We didn't, because we live in a city. So even if we try to go outside, it's either light pollution or just clouds.
Rain.
Because it's always cloudy in Manchester. So nothing for us, sadly. But the speaking of interstellar objects, the 3I Atlas is going to be visible in December. So I will try to take myself to a dark location and try to look at it with the naked eye. And I hope you guys do too.
So go on, one more question. If you could time travel to the end of 2026, so not finishing this year, but let's think about next year, what discovery do you hope we're going to be talking about?
So I think there's, again, so many new instruments launched this year and started operations and everything. But one of the, I don't want to say important, but one of the most exciting things that everybody has been talking about is Euclid. So I think the first data release, the public data release, is scheduled for sometime in 2026. So I will be looking forward to that because I have seen people around the department talk about it. And I think there was a Jotcast episode way back in 2024 with Professor Chris Consoles and also our very own Jonathan. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the Euclid data release and looking forward to seeing what comes out of that. Other than that, SphereX is a mission that has also launched. It's very niche. It's very focused on doing sort of a specific thing, which is intensity mapping of neutral hydrogen. But it launched this year, so I'm looking forward to seeing what images and things it puts out. Just things.
Data. Yeah. Always data.
Always data. Just whatever form data comes in. Always looking forward to new data. Yeah.
Definitely. And I think that's a perfect place to kind of finish off our kind of summary is always looking forward. I suppose, what are you most excited for next year?
There are a few things happening that I'm really excited for. So firstly, the 80-year anniversary of our very own observatory, Jodrell Bank, is coming up, which is what we are named after, Jodcast. So this is happening in December, and we have some celebrations planned. We also have a cool community-made quilt that I'm looking forward to sort of admiring whenever we go to Jodrell Bank next. There's that. And a very exciting thing that's coming up is 20 years of Jodcast. So two whole decades. So I'm looking forward to what celebrations Jodcast has got planned. Looking forward to having a fun time celebrating with the whole team. I guess stay tuned to hear more about our anniversary.
Definitely. And it's going to be a very exciting time, both for Jodrell Bank and for our humble little podcast. And hopefully there's always stuff going on and things to catch up on. Most importantly, how can the listeners get involved next year?
Yes. So, you can send us any and all of your questions about the mysteries of space and the universe and anything in between via our email and also our Instagram. So, Barbara is looking out for all the DMs on the Instagram, so DM her. Also, these questions will be answered by a friendly neighborhood astronomer from Jodrell. They will be tasked with answering your burning questions in the following episode. But yeah, in general, stay tuned, and we are keen to involve our listeners in our 20th anniversary celebration.
I think there'll be some exciting stuff, and we really hope that whether you're here in Manchester or whether you are one of our international listeners from around the world, you'll be able to take part in some of our exciting celebration projects, which will be very exciting. I don't know what yet, but it's super exciting.
Something will happen.
It's going to be a great, great celebration, great year.
And that was our end of year roundup. Now over to Sahini, where she'll introduce our Jod Bite.
In this Jodbite, Louisa speaks with Catherine Edmondson, a PhD student here at the University of Manchester, working with Eamon Cairns on the detection and characterization of exoplanets.
Hello, so for our next Jodbite, we have in the studio here today Catherine. Hello there.
Hi.
As well as Phoebe.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking all about your work in exoplanets. So what specifically in exoplanets do you do?
So I work on demographics, which is to do with looking at relationships between exoplanet parameters like the mass, the radius, temperature, things like that, and looking at how many of those we expect to see within the population and seeing if I can find any relationships between those things as well.
Nice. Okay, what drew you to exoplanets? What do you enjoy about studying exoplanets?
It's something that's always really fascinated me. I guess it makes a bit more intuitive sense to me than some of the other areas of astronomy. Like, you don't have to have an existential crisis like you might in cosmology to be able to follow what's going on.
Yeah, there's something about the scale of it. You know, you're looking for planets.
It's
like
a scale you can imagine rather than something being really tiny or impossibly big.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. So your work is to do with demographics and understanding the population of exoplanets.
Yeah.
How do we separate the different types of exoplanets that we see?
So currently we separate them roughly into about three different groups, which is similar to what you'd see in the solar system. At the smallest end, you'd have rocky planets like Earth, which may or may not have an atmosphere, but they're pretty much composed of some sort of iron-based core and then a rocky mantle. We don't tend to consider the crust because it's not a very big fraction of the planet's mass. And then the next size up, we often refer to them as mini-Neptunes, pretty much a lot of volatiles, a lot of ices, usually with a rocky core. And they tend to be a lot less dense and a lot bigger than the rocky planets. And then at the very upper end, you've got planets like Jupiter, which could even be many, many times bigger than Jupiter, but they're predominantly made of hydrogen and helium in similar ratios that you'd see in a star.
And do exoplanets fit into these kind of three categories very well, or do you find that there's a lot of outliers and a lot of spread in their characterization?
As far as we can tell, they seem to fit fairly well, but there is a bit of overlap. Like, it's not always easy to tell because we have limited information about the planets that we're looking at. It's sometimes difficult to tell exactly what they're made of because you have lots of different layers. So we tend to use the bulk density to measure this, where we'd measure the radius through transit observations, and we measure the mass usually through radial velocity observations, and you can get the average density, but that doesn't tell you much about which compositional model it could be if you've got lots of different possible layers. So there's a lot of different debate at the moment about whether something like a water world would exist. And it's a very ambiguous transition between rocky planets and Neptune-like worlds.
So the transit method is kind of the planet kind of transiting, I can't think of another word.
Eclipsing
the star in the system. But radial velocity, can you give us a little whistle-stop tour of that one?
So radial velocity method uses essentially the Doppler shift of spectral lines in the star. So we'd observe the star. We never really observe the planet directly when we're looking for exoplanets, but you'd look at the spectral lines of the star over time and you'd find that they shift because as the planet is orbiting its star, the gravitational field of the planet tugs at that star in its orbit. So the star will be precessing around its own kind of little orbit, which will be the system center of mass. And so the star is essentially moving towards and away from you in time, and you can measure that and figure out roughly how heavy you think the planet is around it. It's not a perfect result because you don't know whether that planet is in your line of sight or not, and that decides how much of that wobble you see, but you can usually get a limit on how big that planet should be.
So within sort of looking at the demographics, what specifically are you looking at or sort of working on?
So the formal title for that is Forward Modelling of Demographics in preparation for the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which is due to launch next year in October. So what I'm essentially doing is modelling the galaxy with our best knowledge of what it looks like and all of the underlying parameters, modelling planets with our best knowledge of how they're distributed, and then simulating what Roman will see and then have a go at retrieving potential demographic relations from that. And the idea of that is that if you just observe a load of planets and see a distribution of their masses, it's very difficult to know how correct you are because you don't know what you haven't observed, so to speak. Mm. It's difficult to account for the biases and the inefficiencies in detection. But if you try and simulate the whole truth and then see what you retrieve out of that using the tools that you're going to use in the real experiment, you essentially run a fake experiment and you can get numbers for how accurate we think we're going to be with Roman in certain areas of parameter space. Like, we can figure out what might be a good avenue to go down, like what might we get really good data from and what might not really be very well retrieved.
Are there lots of like biases and limitations in what we've seen so far?
There's tons and tons of biases depending on the survey type and even the detection method that you use. Typically, the methods we use to find a lot of planets close by would be we'd search for them using the transit method, and then we'd follow up with radial velocity to get a mass estimate. But those are both heavily biased towards planets that are larger compared to their star and closer in, because they orbit more frequently, so you can get lots of repeats. Like, we're talking orbital periods way less than the Earth, so hours, days, things that you can observe many, many times to really hone in your data and get it more accurate. So we're a little bit more blind in that regime to smaller planets or ones that orbit further from their star. That's where methods like microlensing are a lot more beneficial. And there is also discrepancies in where within the galaxy we're looking for exoplanets. Currently, we've got a lot of data about exoplanets of the order of a few parsecs away from us. But in the scale of the galaxy, we don't actually know if there is any distributions according to like galactic distance or location in the galaxy that might show any differences as to how exoplanets form or exist in those different regions of the galaxy.
Still a lot of work and a lot of research to start understanding the wider picture.
You mentioned microlensing.
Yes.
What is that?
So it relies on the framework of gravitational lensing, which is essentially the distortion and magnification of a distant source due to a massive lens in the foreground. So typically you'd see this when you're studying galaxies in cosmology. You'd have a galaxy in the foreground and then a smeared arc pattern around it where it's lensed the light of a distant galaxy much further away. Within our own galaxy, we tend to, instead of looking at the actual shape of the image pattern, we usually can't resolve the pattern itself if you're looking at a star lensing another star. So because these things are a lot closer to us and things are moving in time, we look at the time-dependent magnification as these two things come in and out of alignment. So that is microlensing. And then to hunt for exoplanets, if there is a planet orbiting the lens star, you get a little perturbation onto that curve. It's quite a smooth, well-defined, unique-shaped curve. And if there's a planet, then you get almost like a little blip somewhere on that curve that you can then attribute to a planet orbiting the host.
We hear so many times of the greatest discoveries being the tiniest blip or a little scruff.
Yeah.
But it's the details in a well-defined or well-expected curve that tend to be the exciting thing. So very interesting that the tiny little blip will actually be a planet. And do you think microlensing, is that well used? Is that a conventional method, or is this something that we're hoping to employ more in the future?
It's not as well adopted as the other methods because it is a bit trickier to do. You're not usually looking for planets that have a periodic signal like you would with transits. Usually because you're looking at a distant star aligning with a foreground star, this is a transient event. You only see this once. So we're relying on probability and statistics, essentially. You look at as many stars as possible and monitor them as regularly as possible, and one in a million or one in 10 million might undergo a microlensing event with a planet around it. With newer telescopes, we're observing many, many more stars, which is making this a lot more viable to get a reasonable yield of planetary microlensing events, which motivates one of the three core missions of the Roman Space Telescope, which will be to observe quite a large chunk of the galactic centre. And over several observing seasons, it will almost continuously monitor many, many different stars to see if we can get as many microlensing events as possible.
Yeah, more of a chance occurrence rather than the kind of systematic. Mm-hmm. There have been several kind of like really big missions to look at specifically at exoplanets or have been really successful in finding them. So how will Roman differ from these other exoplanet missions, and what's it going to add?
So Roman has a similar kind of resolution to the Hubble Space Telescope, but it's got a much, much larger field of view. So rather than a mission like James Webb that's going for precision in measurements, Roman is an improved version of previous generations of telescopes that is aiming to detect as many events as possible. It will be the first space telescope with adaptive optics, and it is fitted with a coronagraph as well, which will be a test for the future Habitable Worlds Observatory to see how good we can get with direct imaging and really push the contrast levels with that.
Mm. And Habitable Worlds, it's a US mission, but it's got quite a UK...
Yeah, there's quite a big UK involvement in the community.
Yeah, exciting stuff. So there's definitely more missions continuing the work in exoplanets and hopefully uncovering different corners of the demographics that we didn't understand before.
When's the Roman mission meant to come into existence?
So it's due to launch October next year, which Ooh. Is a little bit ahead of schedule. But it's less wow. than a year away now.
That's quite rare for for any kind of space missions to be early. Well, on time, but early is a novelty. So you're doing your PhD as this mission is being kind of finalised and now about to be launched. How is that as a PhD student to work alongside of that? How do you find that experience of...
It's incredibly exciting because I have an opportunity to contribute towards something that is new and I get to watch it being developed and I can be involved with the teams that are developing those frameworks. And it does also mean that there is a possibility I will get to use some of the data if data has been sent back in the first release by the time I'm still doing my PhD. I still have a few years left, so there's a good chance.
Definitely. Again, you hear stories of like students that never get to use the data that they've been working on or missions that keep getting pushed back. So fingers crossed. And how have you found PhD life? What do you enjoy about the PhD experience? Are there any challenges to it?
I definitely really enjoy like the problem solving side of it. Like working on a code and getting things to work and then coming up with results that make sense is really exciting. And I also think it's quite nice when you go to events and things, like we had our internal symposium this past week, and you actually get to see in the bigger picture what your work is contributing towards.
Yeah, there's definitely, especially here at Manchester, there is it's a big department, and your work is like a portion of that. But it's nice to see how it fits into the wider research groups and then hopefully beyond Manchester. Nice.
Do you have a favourite exoplanet?
I do, and it's not in any way related to my current research. But my favourite exoplanet is HD 189733b, which it is a bit sad that I remember that telephone number. But this was back when I was still doing my A-levels before I'd actually got into Manchester to do a degree, and I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to do. But I'd been reading a few books over summer on kind of space and physics topics to figure out what I wanted to do. And I read a book called The Planet Factory by Elizabeth Tasker. And one of the planets in there was this planet. And from some of the other kind of Googling about it as well, the way it's conveyed to the public is that it is a planet that rains molten glass at Mach 7, which whether that's actually the case or not, I don't know. But it really started to open up a curiosity for the weird and wonderful conditions that might exist out there that are nothing like what we see in the solar system.
It is kind of mind-boggling to think about the different the potential different planets out there and the potential for life on those different planets. Fab. And I expect it's worth mentioning you're doing your PhD here at Manchester, you did your undergrad here at Manchester. How's the experience now going from undergraduate to postgraduate here at Manchester?
It's nice to not have exams, I'll say that. Yeah, it is a bit of an odd transition, but it's nice to be able to really get stuck into a project for years without the pressure of having to learn everything so that you can then write it back down in a piece of coursework or exam. It's doing research for the sake of doing the research rather than just having to know things.
Definitely. And you've always been very keen to study exoplanets here at Manchester and get involved with the team. So you're obviously very excited for Roman. But is there anything else that you're really looking forward to in the rest of your PhD or in the future for the field of exoplanets?
I guess within my own PhD, I'm looking forward to getting some work published, which is supposed to be in the works fairly soon. I think it'll probably be next year by the time that happens now, but hopefully we'll have a publication out quite soon, which will be quite nice to be able to see that and hopefully see the impact that that has and how it gets received by the community.
How do you think your work is going to impact the wider field, or are there any other kind of missions on the horizon that you're looking forward to?
I would hope that my work can contribute considerably towards the outcomes of what we're looking for and how we determine how accurate our results are from Roman. It is a fairly new approach to take the kind of forward modelling approach to do that, but it seems to be gaining a bit more traction now.
It's good. It's seeing what you're not seeing in a way, and that's a really valuable tool for understanding what fraction of the galaxy you understand or what exoplanets we're actually finding. So thank you so much for coming and speaking to us.
Thank you for having me.
No worries, and best of luck. Fingers crossed for Roman to launch next year.
Thank you.
And that was the Jot Bite. Now, time for some listener feedback. Via email, TK Aerospace says, "Thank you so much for putting together another wonderful year of the Jotcast. It's so wonderful to have the podcast back up and running again. I still maintain that the Jotcast is among the best astronomy podcasts in this or any universe. And thanks for the festive poem."
And remember, if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, or actually, just send us some post. Links and details can be found on our website at www.jodcast.net. Thank you to Kai Schmitz and Catherine Edmondson for the interviews. The audio editors were Tom Williams, Jamie Inslee, and Josh Bishop. The show editors were Alex Wars and Louisa Mason. The show lead was Louisa Mason. The producers were Lily Crayer-Magnus and Phoebe Ryder. Until next time.
Jot on!